The land that made espresso famous made coffee from barley during World War II. Let that sink in for a minute, the idea that Italy, of all places, made coffee from grain, not coffee beans. This is one of the elements in research conducted at the University of Oregon by our next guest. Diana Garvin is an assistant professor of Mediterranean Studies in the Department of Romance Languages at the U of O. We get a chance to visit about the broad array of research subjects in her grasp in this month's edition of Curious, Research Meets Radio, our monthly visit with a University of Oregon researcher. Welcome, Diana Garvin.
Hi there, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
It's good to have you. I watched your interview with U of O today, a video interview, and enjoyed your description of Italian as a bouncing, spiraling language. Great description. What does that mean, though?
So Italian is one of the most fun languages to listen to and to speak. It's no surprise that opera comes from this language in particular with all of its open vowels. You get more airflow in Italian than you do in most other languages. It makes it a beautiful singing language and also a huge amount of fun to speak.
Oh, airflow. That's a great description. Yeah, you do tend to open your mouth a bit more in Italian than with some other languages.
You really do. It's also spoken at 2.5 times the speed of English, making for, it's why you need espresso to fuel all of those conversations.
I never realized somebody clocked that stuff. That's fascinating. 2.5 times the speed of English. That's amazing.
In fact.
Yeah. So knowing the language certainly opens many doors of research to Italian history and culture. Where have you tended to focus that research?
So in my work, I look at food as a lens to observe politics and power. And specifically, I focus on fascism and neo-fascism. These are periods when tendencies that are always present in society become blown up, and they're much easier to identify. So currently, I am using coffee as a way of looking at Italian emigration and also Italian colonization.
All right, so Italy did have colonies in East Africa, and these are places where coffee came from?
Exactly. So in 1935, dictator Benito Mussolini launched the occupation of Ethiopia. And this is where we get the original word for coffee, the Kingdom of Kaffa, spelled K-A-F-F-A. So this is the interior of Ethiopia, the cloud forest from which we get Caffè Arabica.
Hmm. All right. So why? I mean, was it to get coffee? I mean, was there some other reason for taking over Ethiopia?
So originally the Italian fascists had envisioned Ethiopia as a Hitler version of Lebensraum, so living space. Basically a place to put excess population and a way of building proletarian empire. So this was a way to shore up fascist popularity at home with people who were living in the hinterlands of Italy. So goal number one was actually to get grain for Italy. But soon people realized that more money could be gained from selling coffee than from selling grain. So that's when those imperial ambitions shifted.
Well, here again, you know, the history itself is fairly well detailed, and you probably could spend a lot of time just looking at Mussolini directly, but when you're looking at food, you're looking at a different segment of society then.
You really are, and it's where things become much more interesting. So there are a few different schools of history. One that people used to follow is called the Great Men School of History. So it followed the stories of the great and powerful, but it also occluded a whole lot of resisting voices. In my research, I do what's called history from below. So it's looking at it's the history of those that didn't write it. It's women, the working class, ethnic and racial minorities. And in the case of this project, it's zeroing in specifically on the Ethiopian patrons' resistance movement. It turns out that part of the reason that Italy had such an unsuccessful attempt at colonization in Ethiopia, which remained an independent country, because the very areas that they most hoped to conquer, those wild coffee forests, were also perfect cover for guerrilla warfare. So you have resistance at the level of the farmers, and they were actually quite successful.
Interesting. So they got a lot of cover there in that area because of the stuff that grew around that made it, you know, the same things that made the coffee grow well also gave hiding places for people in the resistance.
Exactly. The same territory, if you were to pick the perfect territory for a defensive position, you would look for highlands, so somewhere where you can see what's going on below. You would look for intense tree cover. You would look for diversity of agriculture. All those things make it very hard to see the movements of an army, and that's exactly what you had in the highlands of Harar, also around Gala and Sidamo, all the hotbeds of Ethiopian resistance.
We're getting some history, we're getting some food, we're getting a lot more with Diana Garvin, a University of Oregon Assistant Professor of Mediterranean Studies in the Department of Romance Languages. She looks at food as a lens to examine daily negotiations of power, particularly with a look at women, because the people who are powerless will tell you a lot about the way a society functions, as well as the ones who have great power. Join the conversation in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So here again, because you're looking at the people who made food, put it on the table, we're not talking about having Mussolini artifacts, for example, necessarily, but you apparently use cookbooks, menus. I mean, what other kinds of artifacts do you use in your research?
So one of the great pleasures of this kind of research are the collections held by all of these different museums and archives. In addition to more traditional materials like government memos, financial records, I look at things like antique espresso machines and 100-year-old boxes of chocolate.
100-year-old boxes of chocolate. What do those tell you?
So, in fact, they tell you quite a bit. In fact, let me tell you a story of an interesting debate I once had with an archivist over what matters in a box of chocolate. This is at the Wilsonian Museum in South Beach, Florida. I was looking through their Ethiopian and Eritrean collections. They have a wonderful collection of what's called trade cards. So these were decorative cards. They're almost like baseball cards. But they told, they basically showed pictures of historical events with a narrative on the back. And they were tucked into chocolate boxes as well as other consumer goods, sort of like a gift with purchase. I came across one, a picture card that showed a photo of the coffee plantations on one side, and then an Italian version of that history on the other. And across the back was a smudge, a 100-year-old piece of chocolate. I got so excited. So I didn't taste it. I was very tempted but did not taste it. Instead, I ran up to the head of the archive and said, look at this amazing find. Look at this 100-year-old chocolate. And I tell you, he was absolutely horrified. He said, "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. We'll scrape that off. We'll make sure we get rid of it right away." I said, no. We need to put this into a plastic bag. We need to send this off to the Smithsonian Museum. Some of their librarians can run a chemical analysis. We'll see exactly what was going into chocolate 100 years ago." And he said, no. See what it's doing to the picture on the back. It's all the films, the oil of the cocoa butter, that's coming through. It's destroying the picture. And we started to realize what we had on our hands was a historical debate of what is worth saving. Do we want to know what went into the chocolate and how you might have made a recipe for, you know, a 100-year-old Mars bar? Or do you want to know what about that? Those images of history, what things looked like? And we came to a compromise. So we scraped off the chocolate that was starting to damage the picture, and we did send that off. We're still waiting to hear what went into that chocolate from the folks in D.C.
I'm glad you gave us the conclusion, because by this point we needed to know how that story ended. So, all right, so the chocolate was taken off the card, but you're going to know soon what actually went into that chocolate.
Exactly. And I'm curious to know where those different pieces of cacao were coming from. Because the question of where ingredients were sourced tells you a whole lot about what was going on at any given point in history.
Was there any cacao grown within the Italian Empire under Mussolini?
There was not. They tried to grow... They mainly focused on citrus, chocolates, and grain. What's interesting is the most successful gardens were actually those that where the Italian colonists gave up the imperial project and started trying to learn from Ethiopians living nearby, adapting local methods for growing teff, which is the base grain for injera, that spongy sourdough bread that's the base of so much delicious East African cuisine.
Interesting. So instead of trying to impose Italy upon Ethiopia, eventually they went, you know, maybe Ethiopia knew what they were doing.
Exactly. It was, overall, Italian colonization was a stunning failure. In fact, some of the only successes were the culinary fusions that emerged from the exercise. To this day, pasta is a large part of Somali foodways, for example, and it was partially because it fits so well into nomadic foodways. Pasta doesn't go bad, it's light, it's dry, and you can pack it if you are on a long caravan ride through the desert.
Diana Garvin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an assistant professor of Mediterranean Studies in the Department of Romance Languages at the University of Oregon. We're talking about food as a way to understand history in the world, and in this case, the period of Italian Empire attempted under Mussolini in the fascist years of the 1920s into the 1940s. You can join our conversation here on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Mussolini wielded great power during the fascist period in Italy. The frequent quote, of course, is he made the trains run on time. But how aggressively did he attempt to change what people were eating? I understand he attempted to ban pasta at one point.
In fact, he did. I maintain it is why fascism fell. So the idea behind banning pasta is that Italy never could grow sufficient grain to support its pasta habit. So Mussolini attempted to change what Italians ate on a day-to-day basis. Specifically, he pushed rice as a substitute. And to this day, many older Italians still refuse to eat rice because of memories of wartime deprivation.
Wow. Now, speaking of wartime deprivation, then coffee itself, as we led off with the segment, changed during the Second World War.
It did. So people were only drinking about a half a cup of coffee per day, if you can imagine that. So the amount of coffee that we now associate with the average Italian coffee drinker style has vastly changed. But that half cup of coffee was a critical part of people's days, so much so that when coffee was no longer available during the later year, once we're getting into 1942, 1943, the darkest years of World War II, people will look for anything as a substitute. They were using lettuce, they were using barley. At the very end, they were even using bits of newspaper, anything to color the water in hopes of evoking, if not the taste, at least some of the dark shading that they associate with coffee.
Yikes, newspapers, just to add the darkness to it. Wow, that sounds like a pretty heinous cup of stuff.
I imagine it was pretty terrible.
Yeah.
And, of course, today the prestige of coffee has flipped in that now Italians will deride Americans for drinking acqua sporca, or dirty water, because we take our coffees long with so much more water in them and so much less espresso.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you know, it becomes clearer as we examine the things that changed during the Second World War. I mean, what we can learn from women as food preparers in that regime. If you're the person charged with putting meals on the table, you have to deal with what's available.
In fact, and you see a trip to the grocery store means something very different in 1922 versus 1942. So at the start, the stores are fairly well stocked. You can go down, you can perhaps get a little bit of pasta and oil and cheese on credit. By the time you get to the heart of World War II, what shopping means is actually foraging. It means going out into the woods, gathering the different, gathering whatever wild herbs you can find. It also means raising animals in the backyard. So there were, in La Cucina Italiana, that famous Italian cooking magazine that you can get, you know, right here in the U.S., You start to see recipes that don't start with instructions, kind of like the Julia Childs joke, first get your chicken. They start with first get your rabbit. Go out into the backyard, find your rabbit, and then the recipe will begin.
This is not something that would be available to people like living in a city like Rome, I would think. But, I mean, is the Italian society at that time fairly good at foraging? I mean, I can't imagine Americans at that time knew much about what to do if they went out in the woods.
So, shockingly, this actually did apply to people in Rome as well, at least in terms of raising chickens and rabbits in courtyards. A lot of the new public housing that was being built in the city exurbs during this point included space for a cortile, and in that cortile, you would have hutches and chicken runs. So at least in terms of meat, even urban dwellers were expected to have that sort of access. In terms of the foraging, yes, that was something that was only available to people in the countryside. By and large, farmers did better than city dwellers did, especially as the war went on.
Diana Garvin, I understand that in examining this period in history and this part of the world, that you're educating yourself in an additional language to help your research.
In fact, yes. So typically when people think, somebody is working in Romance languages, they're specializing in Italian, that's where the language knowledge stops. But in fact, this project is transnational because the history of Italy is transnational. So the Italian history of coffee is not just Italian. It's Brazilian and Ethiopian as well. I started learning Portuguese as a college student just because I loved Romance languages in general, also because it's something of a second language in Boston where I'm from. And then more recently, I started learning Amharic, which is the national language of Ethiopia. I first saw Amharic written in, it's the Giz script system, in a beautiful menu at the Academia Barilla Gastronomic Library, where they have a historic menu collection. And from when I first saw that gorgeous script, I started thinking, man, it would be so cool to learn that. With the coffee project, it suddenly became a necessity. There are some financial records that I look forward to reading soon, but they're written in Amharic. So without that sort of language ability, that part of history would remain housed in a different department. Only an East Africanist would be able to really understand that history. My hope is to work more closely with those other departments because this is a common history.
It would seem there's quite a blend in your teaching, that you've got Romance languages, history, political science, and basically wherever food takes you, which is a lot of different directions.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So it's many different directions, but it's centered on one common story. The idea is you need to pick up these different tools to follow where that story is going. So, for example, if I am looking at Italian coffee plantations in Ethiopia at the heart of fascist imperialism, I need a few different tools. I need, let's say, decolonial methodologies that come from history. I would need some eco-critical understanding to know what's going on with interactions between people and the land. And I would need language knowledge that's going to span Italian for the imperial records and then Amharic for the voices that are speaking back to those accounts.
There's a lot of different tools that have helped you that would help students as well. I want to ask, though, Diana, how much you bring the past into the present and get students to consider the rise of nationalist leaders, the likes of Mussolini, in today's world.
That is the project that I'm looking forward to attacking this spring. I'm going to teach a new course called Fascism and Neo-Fascism. This is under the Wolf Professorship through the Oregon Humanities Center. And in this course, students are going to be looking at the problematic objects of fascist material culture. So these are things like songs, baby dolls, even decorative lamps, just all the strange objects that comprised day-to-day life under fascism.
The baby dolls, because they had their arms in salutes or something? Is that what I read?
Yes. In fact, there were So these were called the Piccola Italiana, or the Little Italian Dolls. That was the name of the fascist Italian group for girls. So you can think of this as dictatorial Cub Scouts. These dolls, the only way to play with them was to... the only part of the bodies that moved was the right arm, which you would raise into a permanent Roman salute. So I'm asking students to look at these objects, which are, of course, marked by fear and hatred, in hopes of understanding the broader context and societal elements that spark these movements, and then teaching them how to engage with and argue back with some of those ideas. So the idea is to teach empathetic leadership and argumentation in hopes of sparking more civil debate beyond the classroom.
Huh, wouldn't that be a nice thing?
I have
about half a minute left. I just want to ask about your situation at the Peroni Beer Archive in Rome and what happened there.
That was a wild research trip. So like I said, I study the material culture of food, and I was interested in the changing portion sizes for beer under fascism. Were people drinking more or less? Mm-hmm. What started out as a basic question rapidly turned into a bit of a social problem. I was there with a colleague from University of St. Andrews. At lunch, we came down to the cafeteria. We were chatting in English, and then we started to notice that as we went through the cafeteria line, everyone started going silent. Now, if you've ever been into a cafeteria, the last way you'd describe it is silent. We took our trays down to the table, and we noticed does it seem like everyone's glaring?
I'm going to have to cut this short because we're almost out of time, but they basically thought you were Anheuser-Busch takeover people?
Exactly. They thought that we were there to take over the company.
Wow.
The only English speakers in town, we must have been with the rival beer company.
Diana Garvin, thank you.